old enough to know all about boys. But still, her mother has left her behind. "Stay near the house and be good," she said. Amy rubs her smooth, smooth legs and imagines herself in a hospital waiting room, inhaling the mentholated smoke from a cigarette, ankles coolly crossed. Her hair is thick and wavy. Her full breast rests on the shelf of her arms. She wears a low-cut black satin dress. The nurses look in on her now and then, whispering to one another. "It's her grandmother, you know. They were very close. Look how strong she is. Look how well she's taking it."
"Well now, missy," Fritz says musingly.
His thick glasses have slid down on his nose. Sweat shines on his forehead and cheeks, and he gives off a sour cheese smell. Amy stares at his hands, which are folded on his knee like spiders embracing or fighting to the death. Each hand squeezes the other in turn. Ugly hands, notched with warts and scars, the pinky finger missing from the right hand. A magazine girl wouldn't have a grandfather with hands like these. A magazine girl wouldn't be left alone with such hands, wondering what they will do. Lately she feels Fritz looking at her as if she is someone else, someone he doesn't quite recognize. Yet,
"Maybe we should pray," Amy says, "because that's what Mary Margaret would suggest at a time like this. Lord, help me to accept what I cannot change," is Mary Margaret's favorite prayer. It is written on the prayer card that's taped to the bathroom mirror with crumbling yellow tape, and Amy sometimes picks at it with her fingernail while she's brushing her teeth. All week long, as twisters hopscotched across the state, Mary Margaret said that prayer as she watched the sky. "And, oh, Jimmy," she sometimes said. Amy pictures her grandmother lying alone in a cold, white room and wonders if she is praying now, or if she's already dead. Perhaps her ghost has freed itself and is rustling through the air like a leaf. Perhaps it will return to familiar places, the rocking chair in the kitchen, the parlor chair embroidered with roses that stands just several feet from the couch where Amy is sitting now. The back of her neck feels strange, and she wishes her mother would come home. Outside on the street, a child laughs shrilly, and Amy jumps, thinking it's her grandmother's voice she has heard.
"Pray for what?" Fritz says.
This morning in the basement, waiting for the siren at the top of the water tower to sound the all clear, Mary Margaret had been oddly silent. The house rattled with wind, the floorboards creaking overhead as if a strange, gigantic creature were pacing in the kitchen, waiting to devour them as soon as they came upstairs. Amy and Ellen played cards while Mary Margaret watched, and Fritz slept, his snores like a dog's warning growls.
"You go on and pray if you want to," Fritz says, and his voice is a sneer. "Me? When something goes wrong, I don't wait on Jesus to fix it."
"Me neither," Amy says.
She had noticed Mary Margaret first, but she hadn't said anything. Mary Margaret's lips and fingernails had turned the same dark, purpley blue as the sky. Her eyes crossed so deeply that she seemed to be staring into her own self as she slid down in her chair.
"War!"
Amy shouted, slapping her cards on the table, and Mary Margaret clattered to the floor, her rosary beads tangled in her fingers.
"I learned to do for myself," Fritz says. "Nobody ever did nothing for me. From the time I can first remember, I worked to earn my keep. But you're growing up soft, gal, soft as your grandma."
He pokes his blunt finger into Amy's side, hard, harder, hurting her. When she gasps, he cuffs her cheek almost affectionately. Amy tries not to inhale his sour cheese smell. She tries not to see Mary Margaret thrashing her heels against the basement floor, the way Amy herself did nothing, shuffling the cards again and again while her mother ran upstairs to call the ambulance. The way she and Fritz looked at Mary Margaret, and Mary Margaret looked back at them, and no one said a word. She is frightened. She is shaking. She wants to be with her mother, tucked against her mother's side like a bird. She wants to be a magazine girl in a black satin dress who is not afraid of anything. Fritz's front teeth gleam yellow as the teeth of old horses, long teeth, mean. Amy starts to get up, but it's as if her legs are concrete. She cannot move, cannot twist away. He touches her newly pierced earlobes, twisting the small green stones until tears form in her eyes.
"What's all this foolishness?" he says,
and he sweeps his hand down the almost flatness of her chest.
"Putting on airs, just like your grandma. Pretty soon the young bucks will come sniffing around, and the next thing we know you'll have a belly out to here."
He stands up and stuffs one of the square satin couch pillows up under his shirt.
"There," he says. "Now I'm a mama, just like you're going to be one someday, right? Ain't that so?"
Amy doesn't answer. Her earlobes burn. She wants to touch them, to see if they're bleeding, the way she checks between her legs whenever she feels wetness. But it is never blood down there, just sweat or a little pee, she isn't sure. Maybe blood is running down her neck and she doesn't know it, like the woman she and Kimmy saw downtown with a dirt-red stain on her white shorts. Maybe Fritz can see the blood and he is secretly laughing at Amy, the way Amy and Kimmy secretly laughed at the woman. Fritz paces back and forth in front of her, one hand holding the pillow in place, lifting his feet high so they fall to the floor with each step. Boom! Boom! She sees that he wants her to laugh, so she tries. He rips the pillow from his shirt, hurls it at the lamp, topples it along with a potted philodendron. Its long trailing vines thrash the air as it falls, arms searching for a grip.
"That's what'll happen to you someday when a man puts a baby inside you."
He kicks her grandmother's embroidered chair. It slides into the wall, unresisting. Her grandmother's chair looks empty, braced against the wall, but her ghost might be sitting there, watching. Her ghost might pick up the fallen lamp and bring it down on Fritz's head, or slip into the telephone wires and cause the phone to ring. It will be the police on the line, telling Fritz he's under arrest. He will be put in the electric chair, and Amy will pull the switch. None of this can be happening, but if it is, something else will happen to stop it. Amy is not helpless. Amy is not alone.
"Your grandma had four of my babies," Fritz said. "The last two was twins, and I went out to celebrate it. By the time I come home, there's no sign of them." "What babies?" your grandma says to me, she and her mama.
When he looks down at Amy, she knows he isn't seeing her, but somebody else. A woman resting her breasts on the shelf of her arms. A woman wearing a black satin dress. A woman whose body swells like bread because of what she and men do together. She scuttles backward, her spine pressed into the wall of the couch, feeling the soreness of her ribs where he poked her. She isn't a magazine girl. She isn't who he thinks he recognizes.
"Folks said that night I got so drunk I thought I had twice the sons I did." "What babies?" her mama tells me. "You never had any more babies but the two you already got."
He kneels down beside her. His face is a mountain, the tufted eyebrows like trees, the eyes pond water gray and speckled with floating leaves. He blinks, and water runs down the slope of his nose, a clear stream that veers off to trace the deep lines beside his mouth.
"You tell me," he says, his voice almost kind. "What kind of devil is a woman who kills two little babies?"
Amy doesn't know.
"You really are devils, all of you," he says. "You are born with it in you, like a bull is born to meanness. Devils to the last."
Amy sees herself with a forked tail and hooves, bald red skin, a pitchfork like a Halloween devil, even though she knows real devils can look like anything they want to, a pig or a fish, a girl, an old man. She swipes at her ears, feels wetness there. Her face burns with shame.
"You pray for your grandma if that's what you want." "Me?"
Fritz punches his chest.
"I hope she rots in hell with her ma."
He gets up stiffly and goes down the hall to the bedroom, closes the door with a sound that is as soft as a kiss. Amy goes into the bathroom and turns on the overhead light. Her left ear is bleeding, the pierced hole ripped into a jagged oval. She works the earring free and washes the lobe with water and soap. Then she takes the other earring out and washes that lobe as well. She tosses the earrings into the trash beneath the sink and washes her hands and face and neck. New blood seeps from her torn ear, and she blots it with toilet tissue, waits, then checks to see if it's still bleeding. For months, she has hoped for her bleeding to start, for the stain on her white cotton panties that means she's a grown-up woman like Kimmy, like Kimmy's friend Jennifer. Now it has happened. She's finally bleeding, and even though it's different, it means the same. She is a devil, just like Kimmy and Jennifer are devils, like her mother certainly must be. But she isn't going to tell them that. Nobody ever has to know. She goes back into the living room and finds her sweatshirt where she left it on top of the TV. She pulls it on over her pink tube top and picks up the knocked-over lamp. She straightens her grandmother's chair. She takes out the vacuum cleaner and sucks up the dirt left by the philodendron, which she replants neatly, wrapping the long, viney arms protectively around the pot. By the time she is finished, the room will look exactly as it did before. No one will be able to tell the difference. Ellen doesn't stay in the gray little room where she has been told to wait. Shivering in her shorts and T-shirt, she hooks her purse over her shoulder and walks down the long hallway, avoiding the nurse's station, looking for a sunny window away from the air conditioning. The hospital smells of coffee and disinfectant, and she wonders why every hospital she's been in has smelled the same. It's a smell that reminds her of having a cold, one that gets up into your head and stays there, making even your own skin smell strange. As Mary Margaret was being rushed from the ambulance into the hospital, she cried out for her mother, her voice muffled and thick behind the plastic mask. Now Ellen cannot shake the sound from her mind. She wonders if James has come home from his trip yet, if perhaps he has arrived at the hospital and is sitting in another cold, gray waiting room that smells of coffee and disinfectant. She imagines him with his knees spread wide, his feet pointing away from each other, listening for the sound of Mary Margaret's voice, the way Ellen has been listening, as if those thin cries could filter like smoke through unseen cracks in the walls. Mama! Mama! She turns the corner and almost walks into a man lying on a stretcher. His feet are uncovered, and his tapering yellow toenails are both beautiful and grotesque. She has heard that after people die, their hair and toenails continue to grow, but she can't remember if this is really true or just something kids tell each other at school. This man is in his 40s, big-bellied, his face grizzled with beard. He stares at the ceiling without seeing it, and Ellen wonders what he was doing when he first realized, however vaguely, that something intricate inside him had failed. Perhaps he was at work, soldering one meaningless piece of metal to another, or lecturing a new employee on protocol, rules he once believed in, which mean very little now. He might have been with his family, sitting down to supper. He might have been playing with his dog, or thinking thoughts that made him stare at the ground and smile soft, secret smiles. Mary Margaret had been watching Ellen play cards with Amy, her hands clasped over her stomach, her rosary braided between her fingers. She had fallen from her chair without a word, her thin legs treading air as if there was somewhere important she had to go. Ellen imagines Mary Margaret lying on a stretcher just like this one, her toenails just as yellow, just as thick and growing. Farther down the hall, a woman in white bursts through a set of double doors. Ellen turns away, but the brisk squeak, squeak of the woman's white shoes is close behind. She has the feeling that even if she broke into a run, the woman would follow at exactly the same distance, businesslike, efficient. "Ma'am, I must insist you stay in the waiting room," the woman whispers loudly. "I'm sorry," Ellen says, whispering too. "It's just that I'm so cold. Isn't there a warmer place to wait?" "Try the chapel, second floor." "Thanks," Ellen says, but the woman is already gone, sucked between another pair of double doors that seal themselves neatly after her. She leaves a message for James at the nurse's station, then takes the elevator, trying not to look too closely at the couple riding with her because she's afraid that if she does, she'll grab them by the collars or clutch at their sleeves. "My mother-in-law had a heart attack, and all I could do was watch," she'll say.
She fell on the floor. She couldn't breathe. I saw it happen. But that won't be what she means, what she wants to say. She feels disconnected, as if she's looking at everything from behind a thick lens. In the basement, she had held Mary Margaret's hands, talking to her softly while Amy stared and Fritz stood over her with the look of a farmer assessing a sick animal. "Here, you sit with her too," Ellen said. But Fritz turned away. Soon she heard him clumping up the stairs, and by the time the ambulance came, he had locked himself in the bedroom. "Keep an eye on Amy, at least," she shouted to him, drumming her fist on the door. "If that isn't too much to ask while I take your wife to the hospital." Then she saw Amy looking up at her. "I want to come along," Amy said. She'd changed out of her sweatshirt she'd been wearing into a skimpy pink top. She held her purse in one hand. Ellen knew if she opened up that purse, she would find lipsticks hidden inside the innocent tissue packs, a slim mascara worked into the lining. Amy put her hands on her hips, small and fierce, defiant and frightened, and Ellen could not look at her. She ran past her down the hall, calling over her shoulder, "Stay near the house and be good." As if this could somehow keep her from growing older and more fierce and more afraid until one day she too would be clutching her heart on the cold concrete floor of a basement, the lipsticks and skimpy pink tops long forgotten, blue-veined legs thrashing air. The chapel is empty. A dozen narrow pews, an altar the size of a picnic table. Ellen walks to the front and kneels before the metal trays filled with candles. Most have been lit, some recently, some burned down into a flat, shiny pool, the dark wick at each center like the pupil of an eye. Ellen digs through her purse for a quarter and slips it into the donation box. Then she lights one of the few remaining candles, holding the match against it until her fingers sting. She and her sisters had gone with Mom to light a candle for their father every Sunday after Mass. They'd line up with the Feiderspiels, who had lost their oldest daughter, the Oosters, who had lost their mother, the Kleppners, who had a sickly son. All of them knew each other's grief. Everyone waited patiently as the others took their turns at the kneeler, clattering coins into the donation box, praying for health, for rest, peace. "I can't think of what to say," she told Mom the first time she was allowed to light the candle. "You don't have to say anything," Mom said. "God knows what's in your heart." The candle burns steadily. The outer husk is sun yellow, surrounding the darker core. "Dear God," Ellen begins. She does not want God to know what's in her heart. Last week, Barb took the kids for the morning so she could drive to Shulesville, an hour away, and interview for an opening at the public school there. "Dear God." The next day, the principal called to offer her the job. She answered the phone in the kitchen as James and Fritz watched TV in the living room. Afraid they might hear, she accepted in a whisper. Afterward, she sat down on the floor by the phone, waves of panic rippling over her. "Who called?" James said later.
"No one."
"No one?" he said. "It seems peculiar you would want to talk to no one for so long." Now Ellen feels as if what has happened to Mary Margaret is her fault. But that's crazy. But that's how she feels. But she's done everything she could for Mary Margaret, cleaning her house, fixing her meals, rubbing salve into her soft peach shoulders. But she cannot stop seeing those thin legs walking, walking nowhere, growing still. God. Shulesville Public pays much more than St. Michael's. With child support, she and the kids can get by, and when she gets her share of the money back, she'll be able to buy a car. But how can she even think about leaving at a time when James will need her so much? If there was ever a chance that her mother and sisters would understand, that chance does not exist now. "You promised for better or worse," they'll say. "How can you live with yourself?" God. The word is empty. She gets to her feet and sees that a man is standing in the doorway of the chapel. Light streams from behind him, making his body glow. For a moment,
Ellen thinks of the saints and their visions of Christ, his body wrapped in light. Perhaps he has come to chide her for her selfishness, and in his presence, filled with grace, she will finally be certain. This is right. This is wrong. But the man simply walks into the chapel, stops, shifts foot to foot. She sees he has been crying, and she has never seen him cry before. James, she says, but his name in her mouth is as empty as God's. She doesn't have anything to say to him.
I thought, he says, talking in gasps like children do when they've been crying very hard and for a long time, when I came home and they told me about the ambulance.
Then he comes to her and embraces her, his sharp nose chiseling her neck. Ellen feels nothing except sadness and perhaps an awkward disbelief.
I know it's wrong, but I was so grateful.
He sobs into her shoulder.
When I found out it was Mother, because I thought it might be one of the children, I thought it might be you.
Choice. Miriam arrives at the house late that night, Bert leaning sleepily against her side. She wears a windbreaker that belongs to one of her grown-up sons and carries a duffel bag that another grown-up son left behind when he moved out.
I keep my family with me, she jokes, kicking off her husband's big boots.
She hugs Ellen and Amy, then moves toward James, arms outstretched.
Can't you give your sister-in-law a kiss?
It's good of you to come, James says formally.
He tries to sidestep the hug, but Miriam is quick, and she links him into her arms.
I can stay as long as you need me, she says, following him into the living room. Sarah can take care of Darby in the house. Sometimes I forget she's just 15, but they say the youngest is the most down to earth.
It's the first time one of Ellen's sisters has been invited inside. Ellen is suddenly aware of Bert's fingerprints on the walls, the dust on the TV set, the clutter of newspapers, cups, and shoes. Miriam walks around the living room, fingering Mary Margaret's knick-knacks and vases, straightening the shade on the lamp. James phoned her himself to ask if she would take care of the children for the next few days so Ellen can stay at the hospital with Mary Margaret. He's arranged this with the nurses. He's organized, rational, calm. There have been no more outbursts of weeping.
So, how is she? Miriam says. She brushes a balled-up sock from the couch and sits pulling Bert into her lap.
The heart attack wasn't severe, Ellen says.
Are you going back to the hospital tonight?
No, Ellen says, just as James says, yes.
Ellen can see James's mind at work, dividing her into shifts. Taking care of my mother, check on the kids, talk with the doctor. Already he has mentioned she might want to take a leave of absence in the fall.
Ellen still hasn't told him that by then she will not be here. She cannot imagine saying, James, I am leaving you, packing only the things she and the kids absolutely need, carrying the suitcases out into the driveway where Barb's red Camaro would be waiting to take her... where?
There's nothing we can do for her tonight, she says. They'll call if there's any change.
And your pa is already there with her, I imagine, Miriam says to James.
He's in his room, Amy says. He won't come out.
Oh, my, Miriam says.
He says he thinks Grandma's the devil.
What? Ellen says. All she needs is for Amy to act up in front of Miriam. Miriam is already convinced that Amy is growing up wild because Ellen isn't home with her the way a mother should be. Suddenly, it is important to show Miriam that she is a good mother, that Amy is under control, that Ellen knows how to handle her children. Don't tell lies, she snaps. Amy's eyes are bright with hurt, but she does not contradict. Instead, she chews on her thumbnail, ripping the cuticle with her teeth. She does not look at Ellen, does not look at anyone, just tears the skin from her finger with a deliberateness that makes Ellen wince.
Why don't you and Bert go to bed now? Ellen tells her weakly.
Amy takes Bert's hand, pulls him out of Miriam's lap, and leads him away without a word. Ellen gets the set of spare sheets from the linen closet in the hall. She presses her face into the clean stacked towels, feeling absolutely terrible. By the time she has fixed up the couch for Miriam, James is already in bed. Instead of rolling to the edge of the mattress the way he usually does when Ellen lies down beside him, he presses himself against her, cups his hand affectionately over her stomach. It takes all of her willpower not to push him away. Only after she is certain he is sleeping does she lift his heavy arm and wriggle out from under it. The sound of his breathing, the smell of his body, the deep hollows of his nostrils. She experiences James piece by piece, part by part. She cannot force herself to assemble those parts. She cannot bear to view him whole. She does not love him. She does not love him. In the morning, Mom and Ketty come over with paper plates and cups, a big glass jar of instant coffee. "You're going to need these," Mom warns. "Everybody wants to see the inside of this house." She and Ketty explore the rooms, looking in closets, peering into cupboards, picking up Mary Margaret's china knickknacks and putting them back in slightly different places. "So, this is what she's so proud of," Mom says to Ellen, deliberately unimpressed. Neighbors start to arrive, the Muellers, the Kaufmans, the Wenzels. They carry casseroles still hot from the oven, angel food cake, pork and beans, and their faces are bright with sympathy. They bring their children who stare at Ellen, not knowing how to react to teacher out of school. Ellen has heard them whisper to their friends that 512 Vinegar Hill is haunted. Sometimes they brag about having to walk past it on their way to school. At recess, they call Ellen witch, just loudly enough that she can pretend she doesn't hear. But now they are silent, and Ellen can sense their disappointment as they look at the ordinary, everyday coffee table, the TV and couch, the familiar picture of the Last Supper hanging on the wall. Their parents' reaction is almost the same. They discuss the tornadoes, their effect on the local crops, the possibility of a long summer of storms. By lunchtime, everyone is eager to leave, and they all get up together. They give Ellen instructions about reheating the casseroles. They say they will come by later for the pans. They ask Ellen to give their condolences to Fritz, who has come out of his room only twice today, once to use the bathroom, once to drag the TV from the living room into his bedroom. "We're sorry. We're so sorry," they say. "She isn't dead yet," Ellen says. Miriam quickly grabs Ellen by the arm and leads her to Mary Margaret's chair. "You're tired," she says. "Now you just rest." She and Ketty finish the goodbyes while Mom sits on the couch across from Ellen and asks her, does she want anything? Another cup of coffee? Piece of pie? Ellen pinches a broken leaf off the philodendron on the end table. She's supposed to be at the hospital by 2 when Mary Margaret will be transferred to a private room. As if she's read Ellen's mind, Mom says, "I know it's hard, but it's an opportunity. She never liked you or any of us. Now's your chance to make peace." "She doesn't want peace," Ellen says. "She'll remember how you cared for her at the hospital. She'll see how you did what's right." "Phew," Miriam says, falling into a chair. "That's the last of them for now." Her short legs dangle, the blunt toes of her shoes kiss. She selects a carrot raisin cookie from a plate and nibbles on it thoughtfully. Early this morning, while Ellen was still in bed, Miriam pulled the living room drapes to let the sunlight in and propped the windows open with mildewed back issues of the Catholic Digest. She vacuumed and dusted, scoured the toilets and sinks. She even shamed the kids into cleaning their room. "I understand," Miriam said when Ellen came into the kitchen for coffee, still in her nightgown, sleep in her eyes. She was dumping limp vegetables from the crisper into the trash. "You get a little behind on your housework. It all comes down like a landslide." "You don't have to do this," Ellen said. "And it's not my housework," she added silently. But it was a relief to let Miriam take charge,
and she drank the coffee Miriam had made and tried to eat the bacon and eggs and pancakes Miriam set before her, even though she wasn't hungry. Now Miriam says, "Sputsy, you better get ready to go. Don't worry about the kids. We'll have a good time together." "I sent them outside to play," Ketty says. "I brought along some trucks for Birdie." "And Amy," she shakes her head, "is tanning. Girls can be so foolish." "Isn't she young to get started on all that?" Miriam says. "Girls these days, they grow up fast," Mom says, and she looks at Ellen meaningfully. "They need a mother's close eye on them." "I better tell them goodbye," Ellen says, and she escapes through the back door, squinting at the bright burst of sunlight. "Hello," she calls, and Bert pops up from between the shrubs along the house. He's making tunnels for the trucks, probably damaging the shrub roots. When Ellen bends to kiss him, his face is peppered with fine grains of dirt. Amy is lying face down on a blanket. The straps of her bathing suit have been pulled around her shoulders. A bottle of coconut tanning lotion nestles in the grass. Where does she get the money for these things? The lotions and lipsticks, the magazines? Ellen can't believe she's stealing. "I have to go to the hospital now," she says. "To see Grandma?" Bert says. "To see Grandma." "Why doesn't Grandpa go to see her?" "I don't know." "I told you why," Amy says without lifting her head. "He says she's the devil, that she kills babies." "Does she eat them?" Bert says. "Just the boys," Amy says. Even a month ago, this could have made Bert cry, but now he stares at her, thinking. "You're lying," he says calmly, and he goes back to his trucks in the intricate maze of trails he's made for them. Ellen sits down on the blanket next to Amy. The air is thick with coconut, a good sweet smell. She plucks a piece of grass and flicks it against the bottom of Amy's foot until Amy rolls over, sits up. "He said there were other kids besides Dad and Uncle. He said all women are devils. He said I am a devil." "Amy," Ellen says. "Don't believe me, then. I really don't care." "It's not that I don't believe you or that I do believe you," Ellen says. "Sweetheart, I'm just tired, that's all, and I have to go to the hospital now. So maybe it would be better if we talked about this later." "You're always tired," Amy says. "I know." "What's wrong with you? Are you sick?" Ellen stares out across the lawn, fighting the urge to lie down beside Amy on the blanket and not get up. There are so many things that she and Amy have to talk about, that she and James have to talk about, that she and her mother and sisters have to talk about, and she doesn't know where she will find the energy now or later or any other time. Somehow she has to pull herself together. She needs to create enough space within herself to think things through. "Look," Amy says, "just forget it. I made it all up about Grandpa." "No, you didn't." "He was mumbling some stuff, but I couldn't really hear it." She lies back down on the grass. "You better go," she says after a minute. "I wish I didn't have to go," Ellen says. Amy takes the bottle of lotion, squirts it onto one slender leg. Tiny bees hover inches above her skin, searching for the sweet. Her earlobes are swollen and red. Are they pierced? "It's not like I'm a little kid and you have to take care of me anymore." At the hospital, Ellen gets Mary Margaret's new room number from the front desk, 333. Easy to remember. She buys a yellow rose and a paperback at the gift shop before she goes upstairs. It's a relief to be moving through the cool, silent hallways. Undoubtedly, the house will fill with a new round of visitors this afternoon. Ellen imagines the dining room table spread with food, congealed meats, sugary fruit breads, Ritz crackers, Jell-O salads. Her stomach churns. She finds a trash can and throws away the neat foil package of tuna casserole that Miriam tucked into her purse. Mary Margaret's room is plain and white, with two small windows and a TV mounted high on the wall. Father Bork is standing beside the bed, and seated on the chair beneath the windows is a woman. For a moment, Ellen thinks it's Mary Margaret, already sitting up. Then the woman turns toward the door as if by instinct, as if she had caught a whiff of Ellen's scent, mouth open to taste the air. Salome blinks her beautiful eyes as if she doesn't quite remember who Ellen is. The bones in her face are fierce, Father Bork comes over to greet Ellen, soft white hands outstretched.
I understand you'll be staying here at the hospital, he whispers.
His hands swallow Ellen's like gloves. Yes, Father.
So good of you, he says.
Mary May's sister wants to stay, but she seems a bit confused. They both do, really, and I was reluctant to leave them alone.
I haven't seen Auntie Salome in months, Ellen says. I don't think she likes me.
Well, I'm sure she'll forget about that now, Father Bork says. One of the blessings of illness is that it draws people together.
He smiles his calm, wise smile. She remembers his office, James nervously squeezing her hand. The hearth and the home.
She keeps her eyes on the floor the way she did when she was a girl, worrying that the nuns could read her mind.
Mary May, Father Bork says warmly, leading Ellen toward the bed.
Mary Margaret looks like a child's paper construction, gray with paste, wrinkled at the edges. IV tubes trail from her arm. Another tube runs from her nose. On a portable stand behind her, a heart monitor flashes silently.
Hi, Ellen says awkwardly.
Look who brought you a rose. You always liked yellow flowers, just like your mama did.
He brings the rose to Mary Margaret's face. Her eyes focus on Ellen. She swallows hard.
Are you come to help? She whispers.
Yes, Ellen says.
You?
Salome says. She rises stiffly. Sunlight cuts in through the blinds, dividing her face into savage shadows. She wears a house coat that might have once been pink. Now it's the color of an old bloodstain, and it hangs straight from her bony shoulders. A frayed black sweater is draped over the back of her neck, cat-like, one long arm twitching.
We won't be needing any help, she says. Come now, Father Bork says. Ellen can make your sister more comfortable. You want her to be comfortable, don't you?
Salome sits back down without answering, but she fixes Ellen with an angry stare.
I have to leave now, Father Bork murmurs to Ellen, but I'll give Mary May communion before I go.
When he turns to prepare the host, tears stream down Mary Margaret's face.
It's supposed to hurt, Salome tells her. The pain is part of God's will.
Father Bork tries to feed Mary Margaret the host, but she bites her lips, shakes her head. He looks at Ellen. She doesn't understand either.
She is dirty, Salome tells them. She is unclean.
Father Bork puts the host away. Salome, my dear, may I speak to you in the hall? She allows him to take her arm. After they are gone, Ellen sits in Salome's chair, not knowing what to do. Mary Margaret is taking short, sharp breaths. She reaches for Ellen, her nails biting into Ellen's wrists.
It's my time, she says.
But you'll be fine, Ellen says. Doctor says you'll be home in a week.
Go get Mama. I need Mama.
When Father Bork comes back into the room, he puts his lips to Ellen's ear.
I sent the sister to the chapel, he says, whispering again. I hate to separate them, but if she's upsetting Mary May, the nurse will make her leave.
She wants her mother, Ellen says. Mary Margaret's eyes close. Sweat shines on her forehead. Father Bork sighs deeply.
Her mother, rest her soul, filled Mary May's head with girlish dreams, and after that she wasn't satisfied with anything. God blessed Mary Margaret with a husband, two beautiful sons, a home.
He waves Mary Margaret's life away with his hand. Ellen is aware of his smell, soap and talcum powder like Bert after his bath. She flinches when he lowers his hand to her shoulder.
It's been hard for you living with her, he says. Your sisters are concerned. I understand you've been having doubts about your marriage.
Julia, Ellen thinks. Her face burns. She doesn't move.
Sometimes God speaks to us through a tragedy because that's the only way we'll listen. Perhaps this is God's way of showing you how much your family needs you. Families forget to say that sometimes. Husbands forget, he smiles. What you're doing here is a good thing, a Christian thing.
He pats her shoulder and leaves.
his long skirt rustling. "Mind your own damn business." That's what she should have told him. Why didn't she? What has she got to lose? She imagines herself sitting by this bed for many years, growing thinner, grayer, brittle, the good Christian wife, the good Christian mother. Salome slips back into the room. "We don't need your help about anything," she says, her chin nodding sharply like the beak of a bird. She sits at the foot of Mary Margaret's bed and begins to pray the rosary. By late afternoon, Mary Margaret clutches her sides and wails with pain. The nurse has been in twice, an older woman with a kind, practical face. "I'll give her another sedative," she says on her second visit. "I don't know what else to do for her until doctor stops by tonight." "Well, can he come any sooner?" Ellen asks. "There's no need," the nurse says. "Doctor was here just before you came." "We don't need no doctor," Salome says. "Birth is a natural thing in a woman. It is death, you know, that's unnatural." Ellen and the nurse exchange looks. The nurse shrugs and leaves. Salome opens her big black purse and takes out a bag of corn chips. She slits the plastic with a pin from her hair, puts a chip in her mouth, and sucks noisily. At home, they must be sitting down to dinner. Miriam, James, Amy, and Bert. Perhaps Fritz, too, for by now he must be hungry. James will be quiet from having slept all day. His eyes glazed, his face still wrinkled from the dingy sheets Ellen hasn't washed in weeks. She sighs, opens the paperback she bought at the gift shop, but her mind spins the words in dizzy circles and she puts it back in her purse. Suddenly her chest feels heavy. She tries to breathe but can't. Anxiety builds in her throat like a taste, and she goes down the hall to the water fountain where she swallows a pill, another, one more, then leans against the wall to wait for the feeling to pass. Her eyes close. She can sleep right here and no one will notice because she is becoming invisible. Soon no one will be able to see her, no matter how hard they try. When she opens her eyes, she sees only her shoes, many miles beneath her, and as she watches, even they disappear, front to back, as though they are being erased by a child's eraser. Father Bork is beside her. He grabs for her feet, catches only air. "What is happening to you?" he shouts. "Sacrifice is never easy," the aqua lady explains. Her aqua body fills the space where Ellen's body once stood. And Amy says, "Women are devils. I am a devil." Her eyes bulge red in her face. Ellen opens her mouth to scream. The back of her shirt is cold with sweat. She gulps water, splashes it on her face, and her fingers seem huge to her, plump and sausage pink. "I am going crazy," she thinks. "This is how a crazy person feels." She rinses her mouth, then walks unsteadily down the hall to Mary Margaret's room. Dim evening light filters between the blinds, and Ellen squints, trying to see. Everything seems to be moving very slowly. She hears Mary Margaret cry out, a low whistle of air, and she pats the wall for the light switch. "Shut the door," Salome snaps. She holds her black sweater bundled in her arms, her body hunched around it as though Ellen might try to take it away. "What's wrong?" Ellen says, and Salome smiles a strange, triumphant smile. Mary Margaret's gown is twisted up around her waist. Her legs are bent awkwardly, her bony knees white as skulls. Ellen smooths her gown back into place, covers her with a sheet. "Shh, shh," Salome says, rocking the sweater bundle, stroking it, tucking it around itself even more securely. Watching her, Ellen shakes with a sudden sick feeling, recognizing the way she rocked her own children. "What do you have there?" she breathes. "Them two Ma killed," Salome says smugly. She tilts the bundle, showing Ellen its emptiness. "I was there the first time they was born, and I can tell you they're the same ones now." Mary Margaret begins to cry, the squalling voice of an infant. "Nothing is there," Ellen says. "There are no babies." "That's what Ma said. She fixed him good for what he'd done to Mary May. But a man has a right to his wife under God's law." Salome stares into Ellen's face. It is the will of God for babies to be born.
There are no babies.
The will of God ain't for everyone to see.
Amy's words rise like a knot in Ellen's throat. She turns to Mary Margaret and realizes how very still she has become, her face milk white, her crying no more than a low, steady moan.
Wait here, just wait here, Ellen says, and she runs out of the room, fighting her way through the sharp angles of the corridors, bumping her hip on a cleaning cart, catching her foot on a wheelchair. By the time she returns with a nurse, Salome is gone. Mary Margaret's face looks like it has been split in two and then put back together, one side lower than the other. The black sweater rests on her chest.
She thinks she's had a baby, Ellen says thickly,
but the nurse isn't really listening. She checks the heart monitor, hits a button, and the hallway outside the room comes to life with footsteps.
What she's had is some kind of seizure, she says. I'm afraid you'll have to wait outside.
At the end of the hallway, Ellen leans against a vending machine, trying to catch her breath, trying to understand. What kind of woman would kill two newborn babies? But she already knows the answer. A desperate woman. A woman who was trapped. A woman who was driven to do something, anything, to change the way things were.
What might I be driven to? Ellen thinks, licking salty perspiration from her upper lip. She does not want to know.
She takes a deep breath and feels her own blood moving inside her, spreading sweet life through her body. Suddenly, it's as if Anne is with her in this cold, gray hospital hall. At last, Ellen has found someone in her family who will understand what she must do before it is too late, before her own rage grows into something she cannot control. Relief wells up in her, warmer than tears. When she tells her family she is leaving James, she will not be completely alone. It is almost 9 by the time she gets home. Miriam's car straddles the driveway, so she parks the car on the street and walks up the lawn, the night air cool and private against her skin, damp grass lapping her ankles. Inside, James and Miriam are watching TV with the children, and their heads could be the heads of any couple sitting side by side. They could be very much in love. They could be talking instead of watching TV, discussing the recent tornadoes, perhaps, or their next vacation, or the neighbor's children. Marv and Sally Gray's son got another speeding ticket. Does that make 2 or 3? 3, I think. Old Marv's got his hands full with that one. Or maybe they aren't saying anything. Maybe they are watching the children, communicating only with pursed lips, a raised eyebrow. He slides low in his chair to poke her foot with his own. She pulls her foot away, edges it back, the children never suspecting their parents are involved in lives they do not yet understand. Ellen stands in the yard for a long time, watching them through the window, the way she once stared through the windows of her sister's dollhouse. She wonders where her own doll would have been placed had Daddy lived to carve it for her. A quarter moon rises above the house, silver back arching, graceful as a fish. Somewhere down the street, a dog barks. In the house, James gets up and turns off the TV, paces in front of the window, and Ellen knows she should go inside. But within those walls, she is the piece that doesn't fit, the doll without a task. Here on the lawn, with the sky stretching wide above her, the pinpoints of stars glowing billions of possibilities, she is whole and strong. Perhaps Mary Margaret once stood beneath a night sky like this one. But she stood in one place so long that even Anne could not save her. For a moment, James stares out the window. Ellen's heart skips, even now, thinking he has seen her. But James sees nothing but darkness, and he turns out the light and pulls the drapes tightly closed. By the time she lets herself into the house, everyone is asleep. She closes the door softly behind her, listening to the sound of Miriam's breathing, which reminds her of Mom and the sweet, warm nights they slept together like spoons. She savors the memory of that closeness, something she cannot imagine she'll ever experience again. Then she creeps past the couch, down the hall toward the bathroom, closing the door before she turns on the light. The pills fill the belly of the ballerina. Ellen unscrews her slender neck and tips them into the toilet. They float like water bugs bumping noses. She flushes, wincing at the sound. Some of them do not go down, and she has to flush twice more before the last one disappears. Then she puts the head back on, careful so the ballerina's chin ends up pointing forward. She curves the soft folds of her skirt into her transparent hands before placing her, high out of sight, on the shelf. Mary Margaret's doll. She will tell James now, in the quiet darkness, the lamp beside the bed casting a rosy calm over what she must say. I am afraid to go, but I am more afraid to stay. I have to take care of myself for a while. James will be confused, coming slowly up out of his sleep, perhaps thinking this is all a dream until he feels Ellen's hand clasp his. Or maybe he will be angry. He will call her names. He will take off his ring and throw it at her feet. She turns off the light and goes out into the hallway, groping her way until her fingers brush the door to James's room at the end of the hall. The wood is cool beneath her hand. She moves her palm along its smooth surface. Only this piece of wood separates them. Ellen presses her forehead against it, feeling James breathing on the other side, content in his sleep, contained, complete, and she does not open the door because she knows that if she wakes him, he will not be angry. He will not think it's a dream. "You're not going anywhere," he will say, and he'll roll over into his stomach with his head pushed deep into his pillow. Or worse, he will look at her as if she hasn't spoken, as if she isn't even there. And if that were to happen, she would not know what to do. Because tonight, for the first time in months, she is certain that she is there. She is someone, a person whose life is of value, and if James failed to recognize that now, she would never be able to forgive him. The children's voices register gradually. First Amy's whisper, then Bert's frustrated whine. A slender line of light winks beneath their bedroom door. Ellen turns away from James and slips into their room. They are playing cards on the floor, a flashlight glowing between them. When Ellen turns on the light, Bert sweeps up the cards defiantly and deals another hand, his small, plump fingers amazingly agile. "You want me to tuck you in?" she says, blinking against the brightness. Her eyes feel hot and sore, as if she's been crying, but when she puts her hands to her face, her cheeks are dry. "I'm too old for that," Amy says. "Me too," Bert says quickly. "Well, okay," Ellen says. "But I think you should get to bed soon. I'm driving to Shulesville early in the morning, and I'd like you to go with me." "What for?" Amy says. "To pick out an apartment." This gets their attention, but they don't say anything for a while. "Will we live there?" Amy finally says. "You and Bert and me." "What about Dad?" Bert says. "Not right now. Maybe someday." Bert deals another hand. "Will he be angry?" "He might be," Ellen says, "but not with you. I think he already knows that we can't go on living here. Grandma's going to need lots of quiet when she comes home." "Who will take care of her?" Amy says meanly. "Isn't that your job?" Ellen holds her voice steady. "I've done the best I can, but it's hurting us all to be living here. We'll still visit as often as we can." "Do we have to?" Bert says, just as Amy says, "I don't want to visit." They look old, sitting together, flipping the cards between them. They keep their bodies turned toward each other, away from Ellen, and she realizes they don't trust her any more than they trust James or his parents. It will take time before she is able to be their mother again,
before she feels close to them the way she used to. Well, Ellen says, I'm not really tired, so I guess I'll go for a walk.
A walk? Bert says, in the dark?
Well, let me tuck you in first, Ellen says. And Bert drops the cards, suddenly young again, and hops up into his bed.
What if you don't come back? He says. What if you die?
I'm not going to die, Ellen says, and she means it. Tonight she can't imagine not being alive in the world. He looks at her suspiciously.
How do you know?
I can just feel it, Ellen says. I am certain of it.
But how can you be certain?
It's like with guardian angels, Amy says to him. You just have to know. Ellen listens to Bert say his prayers, tucks the covers around him, and then she and Amy sit in silence until the sound of his breathing grows slow and deep. She watches Amy, the curve of her neck, the high cheekbones that hollow her face as if she were a woman Ellen's age.
Do you want to walk with me?
Ellen whispers once she's sure Bert is asleep.
There's nothing to be afraid of.
I won't be afraid, Amy says. They follow the cracked gray sidewalk along Vinegar Hill, turn down toward the harbor, their feet making scraping sounds against the concrete. The business district is still out of power from the tornado, and the steeple of St. Michael's is invisible tonight, the wide eye of the clock closed and dark. Ellen and Amy do not speak. They do not look at each other. But they reach the flat coin of the lake, holding hands.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.